You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to my couch, as you always are here live on Wednesdays, 11 in the morning Pacific Standard Time. And as always, I have a great guest for you today. We're talking about the concepts of true crime stories, true crime in real life, and our fascination with that. And who not better to interview than one of the most famous crime novelists who I really enjoy reading his books about. And let's bring him up right now, Mike Cobb. There he is. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks nice to be here. It's nice to be on the couch.
Oh, it's great to have you. It really is. I'm not going to analyze you, I promise.
Okay.
Well, maybe I will.
If you want to, that's fine.
That would be great. Okay, that'll be
I probably could benefit from some analysis. So.
I think you're doing pretty well. I think your writing is therapy, actually, for you.
And most definitely.
Absolutely. Let me tell a little bit about you here for viewers and listeners. And by the way, if you have any questions for Mike, you can email me right here, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. And I'll put it out there and see how Mike feels about some of your questions. By the way, Mike Cobb's body of literary work includes both fiction and nonfiction, short form and long form, as well as articles and blogs. He's the author of 4 published novels, and there's a lot more published information that you can find out about him. But you may have read the books Dead Beckoning, The Devil You Knew, and its sequel, You Will Know Me By My Deeds,
with a concept,
and his crime stories, why we're always listening to the news and what's going down, and movies, and of course, books such as those that you write, Mike, that are just fascinating about crime, why people do, and how we can solve, and things like that. So thanks again for being here. I really appreciate your patience. We've had some technical difficulties. Hopefully we can stay live here and
it's
do this.
It's all my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
No, you're terrific. Can you briefly tell us about your book that we're currently talking about, Muzzle the Black Dog? What is basically the storyline for that?
Yeah, so Muzzle the Black Dog is a psychological thriller. It's a short book, by the way. It's my first novella.
Nice.
But it's a psychological thriller about a man who is living in the woods. We don't know a lot initially about why he's living there, but we know that something went on with his family, something traumatic, and caused him to leave his wife and children. In the woods, he's visited around midnight one night by a stranger, and the stranger knows him, but will not tell him how he knows him. And that sets off a cascading series of events, if you will, that ultimately lead to let's call it, for lack of a better term, self-discovery and redemption on the part of the main character. Woven through and around and in this fictional story is the true story of the Centennial Olympic Park bomber in Atlanta in 1986.
Okay. Yeah.
And his brother. So what really got me on the subject of the idea of writing this book, all of my books are based to one degree or another on, as you alluded to in your introduction, on true crime stories.
Right.
And I had always been fascinated by not only Eric Rudolph, the Olympic Park bomber, and of your viewers who are not familiar, this is the Atlanta Olympics in 1996, where an individual named Eric Rudolph actually planted a bomb at a major event.
Yeah.
In Centennial Olympic Park in downtown Atlanta. And it was quite traumatic. But I was as fascinated by Eric Rudolph's family and his brother and his relationship with his brother. So that sort of is center stage throughout the story.
Right. The dynamics between the two brothers. Sure was. Tell me, what is it that made you so fascinated with crime stories in your life and writing about this and reading, experiencing this?
Yes. Oh gosh. So we have to go back to quite a few years ago when I was 17 years old,
Right.
and a young woman, 6 years my senior, at a time when I was vulnerable, I was trying to find myself, as 17-year-olds often
Yes.
do.
Yep.
So I was in the throes of that. This 23-year-old woman took me under her wing and meant a lot to me.
Oh, yeah.
One morning, I woke up to read the paper and discover that she had been killed execution style. Her body had been found in a construction site,
Oh
sort of
my gosh.
a bad side of town in Atlanta.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, it was traumatic. And I went through, shortly after that, I went through some pretty bad times when I got into some trouble.
Yeah, sure.
And I did not realize until much later in my life that I really think that I was acting out
Sure.
and trying to deal with PTSD
Right.
at a time when I was clueless.
Oh, right. The
That's clearly
shock.
now.
Sure, that's shocking. My God.
Yeah, so I am actually working on her story, which
Oh,
will
cool.
be nonfiction. It will be a true, true crime
Good.
story. The working title is "The Last Thing She Said: A Story of Friendship, Murder, and the Fight for Justice." I have been working for about 6 years now with a private investigator.
Wonderful.
It's a cold case still. And there are four overarching themes that run throughout her story. One is racism, class discrimination, sexism, sex discrimination, and police malfeasance.
Oh, my
And
goodness.
police malfeasance is a big, big part of the story.
Wow. So the cover-ups were happening? Do you suppose cover-ups?
Yes, and shortly after she was killed, except for the bullets, which were diverted to the ballistics lab, all of the evidence disappeared.
Oh, my gosh.
There were some connections between one of the senior homicide detectives and some of the situations surrounding her murder and one of her very close acquaintances. So I'll just leave it at that at this point.
My goodness. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And God, I mean, that is drama for anyone of any age, let alone a 17, 18-year-old,
But that started me on a life of crime, as they say.
Fascination with that. That'll do it. Absolutely. I mean, you want to, it's kind of like the psyche sometimes of some of the investigators who've had trauma in their life as well. They want to get the bad guys. They want to, that's it. You want to find the bad guys. And
Well, and
also,
I want to tell her story. I mean, story's never been told.
No, that's beautiful. And I thank you for that. And so let's get back to the muzzling the black dog. Who's the black dog?
So
Why
the
do we
black
have to muzzle?
dog, you can appreciate this given your profession. The black dog is a metaphor. I sort of compare it. I'm a big fan of Truman Capote,
Yes.
and I sort of compare it to Holly Golightly's Mean Reds and
Yes.
Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Right. Oh.
So it's a combination of angst, depression, and fear, if you will. So it does not become obvious. I don't want to give too much away, but it doesn't become obvious at first. But it's certainly metaphoric. The black dog is metaphoric for things that the protagonist is going through that, frankly, he doesn't even realize at first that he's going through.
So you're talking about sort of some subconscious, we shove things down subconsciously, because, and you're familiar with this as well. I'm sure you went through your own, trauma with it's the stage of disbelief, you know, shock and all that. So we shove these traumas down based on our background sometimes, and we're not aware of
them.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing I will mention about this book is I wanted it to be a psychological thriller in another sense. In that, I wanted there to be places in the book where reader might not be completely certain whether what he or she is reading is actually happening or is in the protagonist's imagination.
Ah, okay. So you're going back and forth from, you know, perhaps the past or the future and the now, things like that.
Yeah, there's some things that happen and they're maybe a little vague or a little unclear, which is by design. Yeah.
Yeah. I love those kinds of movies.
Do you remember Mulholland Drive?
Sure. Yeah, I'm that old.
In that movie, there are things that when you watch the movie, you really don't know. Is this happening or is this not happening?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like, is this going on in this person's mind or is this a fantasy or did it really happen or, you know, that kind of thing. I love that. And why is that intriguing to you? What do you think that's about?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with my professional background. Maybe it has something to do with my interest, not so much in things metaphysical per se, but I just find it all quite fascinating, you know, with that gray line, if you will, between what you know to be real and what you're not sure about.
Right. And that comes into my understanding, and I'm fascinated with quantum physics. I didn't do too well in calculus when I was in college, but I'm more into the concepts of the observer effect and all of the past things that, you know. You are a scientist. You have a PhD.
I have a PhD in physical chemistry.
Love it.
But really with a focus on computational quantum physics, even though it was in chemistry. So, I mean, you know, I'm basically a nerd at heart. Think Big Bang Theory. Okay.
Very cool.
While I don't aspire to be, and my gosh, I hope I'm not Sheldon. For those of you who know Big Bang Theory, I am a nerd at heart.
Love it.
and my science background has actually had a positive influence on my writing in certain ways.
Yes.
One is, I think to be a good scientist, you have to have a keen curiosity.
Yep.
You have to have an analytical eye, and it has also helped me be able to grasp forensic concepts that are key to my writing. And you also have to have a passion for research. And because I write historical fiction,
yes,
deep, deep, rigorous research undergirds all of my writing. So I think being a scientist helps. And then there's also that curiosity about that interface between what we know and what we don't know.
Right.
That I think plays into this issue that we were talking about earlier about that gray area when a reader reads a book or when a viewer watches a movie about is this really happening or is this in character's imagination. I think all of those things play well in the context of my science background.
Sure. I think that sure makes sense. It really does. And good for you. I mean, that's lovely that you have studied all that and forensics as well. You know, your curiosity in scientifically solving things. So, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, you know, in terms of quantum physics as well. You know, it has to do with that unknown, perhaps the timeline of the past. Mm-hmm. Future and the now and all of that going on. So, yes. Right? I think they're all related.
Definitely. They're all, definitely.
Yeah. So, would you describe yourself as a spiritual man?
I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that can mean a lot of different things, right?
Yes. Yes.
Einstein, who never considered himself to be a religious man. Mm-hmm. I think in today's vernacular, he would probably be an agnostic. I don't think he was an atheist, but he was an agnostic.
Right.
But yes. He was a spiritual man, and he believed in the power of awe.
Ah, yes, yes.
And and I think it's important for all of us to be in awe of the things around us, of the things we don't understand, and that's part of spirituality, I think.
Yes. Well, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, and I don't know if you're, yes, I love that. Yeah. No, that's really true. What did he call the quantum effect? Yeah, the spooky effect. He was fascinated with that, right? So, So you talk about your writing, and I've seen you interviewed in the past as well. It fascinates me that you come from an organic place, you say. It's not planned. It's not scripted. You just let it flow, which also I'm a little kooky about, kind of tuning into the quantum field, right? Consciousness, we're all connected, etc. So you believe that these things are within you, in terms of just being organic and letting it flow? Are these ideas coming from a higher you or a higher place? Or how would you describe that?
So fundamentally, they come from my characters who are real, with whom I commune on a regular basis.
Oh my goodness, I love it.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, when I actually start talking out loud, speaking out loud with them, conversing with them, I think sometimes my wife gets a little worried about me. No, I mean, it's all about communing with my characters. And to your point earlier about the organic aspect of my writing, it becomes a little difficult when you're writing historical fiction, because obviously a part of your story has to hew to a chronology of events that occurred in real life. So you have to sort of work around that. But
sure.
In terms of the fictional aspect of my books, the compelling story, if you will, that runs through my books, there's in the writing world, there are a couple of terms that are used. People talk ask a writer, are you a plotter or a pantser? Do you plot out your story, or do you sort of write by the seat of your pants?
Right.
Most definitely a pantser. I'm not a plotter. I do not storyboard. I've got a general idea of where my books might go, but I do not plot anything out.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as I said earlier, there is a plot line with respect to the true story, but in terms of the fictional story, I don't plot it out. And frankly, my characters surprise me.
Yes.
Muzzle the Black Dog ended up in a very different place from where I expected it to be, because my character told me, this is where we are going, my friend. Here's where we're going. And I will tell you, even more so in my third book, which is called You Will Know Me by My Deeds, I had no idea how that book was going to end.
Wow,
so this
I love that.
Poor character who started out being a fairly minor character in the book suddenly took over in my head and was center stage and played a critical role in the end of the book. I don't know that I could write without my characters basically living in my head, me living in their heads, and without them really guiding me every step of the way.
I love that. Sounds kind of like you're channeling these.
I am channeling.
Yes, absolutely. So what is your process? Do you go into a meditative state or in the now, or are you just sitting in front of your keyboard and just kind of come through me? That kind of thing. How do you do that?
I am. I don't think I would call it a meditative state. When I'm writing, I'm basically sitting at my keyboard, just letting it flow, just letting the words flow, without a lot of concern for what I'm typing or where they are going.
Yes.
There is, if you're an organic writer like that, you have plenty of time to edit. you have plenty of time to weave in the factual stuff.
Yes.
One of the challenges of a good writer of historical fiction is not letting the facts get in the way of weaving a compelling character-driven story.
Yes.
So one way to prevent that from happening is to just let it rip when you're writing
and read
about where it's going.
Yes.
And also not worry about, honestly, whether it's good or not. A friend and fellow writing group member sent me a little article from Medium yesterday about a letter that Ernest Hemingway had written to F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Mm, my goodness. Yeah.
Sort of criticizing one of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books.
Yes.
But one of Hemingway's pieces of advice was, you're going to write 90 pages of junk to get one page is a masterpiece. When you're writing, or when I'm writing anyway, it's all about the process. It's not about the product. It's about the process.
Right.
I cannot let my concern for, is this good or not? Is it going to be good or not?
Right.
I can't let wordcraft get in the way
of
the process.
Yes.
Of letting my characters let it rip,
I love it.
Yeah.
So when you're in the now, which is meditation to me, no matter what you're doing, whether you're playing an instrument or drawing a picture or writing a novel.
By the way, you do not want me to ever play an instrument, just so you know.
Can you sing? That's
barely.
Okay, barely. Never mind. But
don't ask you to sing, please.
No. Right. we are in that state of just allowing things to come through to us. I think that's how Einstein worked. He just allowed, organically things to come up after his power naps because he was in the theta alpha brain, which is, you're not going total frontal beta. You're just in the now and you're just sort of flowing with what's coming through. So I think that's beautiful because that is the creative state in my mind.
Yeah. By the way, thanks to one of my very best friends, I am now listening to it's 11th year or something now, a series of wonderful podcasts about the mystics.
Nice. And what particular mystics are they sharing?
Well, I'm early on in the process, but he certainly starts out spending a lot of time talking about Thomas Merton, for example.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. That's very cool. And where they get their information from and what the process is with that, which is very similar to being a creator in the now and allowing things organically to come to you.
Sure.
I think a lot of people who are creative or would like to be, for just a therapeutic sense, they don't feel, they're always questioning themselves, right? I mean, there's that element of, like you said, you just kind of write through the characters, you're feeling them, you're becoming them. There's always an analytical, maybe this isn't good enough, or maybe would you suggest to writers to just let that go and to flow a little bit more? And how would you suggest they get in touch with that?
Well, I think there are times when you should question yourself, but it's really, to me anyway, it's more in the editing process and the actual first draft writing process. I think in the writing process, just to try to push those self-doubts out of the way. And as I said earlier, just focusing on letting the words flow, letting it rip, and those demons, they're not demons really, because I think there's a role for them to play.
Sure.
But just pushing them out of the way when you're writing when you're initially writing, and then there's opportunity to come back and look at what you've written with a critical eye.
Yes.
And question it and think about it. I mean, that's also, that also, I guess, has something to do with my scientific training too, because science is all about questions. It's not about answers. It's not about having the answers. It's about asking the questions. And testing your assumptions every step of the way. Right. Always test your assumptions.
Right. That's right. That's really important because there's so many possibilities, you know, of outcomes. What's the correlation or what's the significance of the outcome of this? Is it a high significance or whatever? So that is so true. Yeah. But that can get in the way of writing and being organic sometimes, I guess.
It can. Most definitely can.
Right. It's that analytical mind. By the way, in case you guys just joined us, you're here on the couch with me and famous author Mike Cobb. His body of literary work includes both fiction and nonfiction, short form, long form, as well as articles and blogs. And you may be familiar with his books. We're talking about his latest, Muzzle the Black Dog, fascinating story. I think once you get into it, you'll be immersed and not want to stop reading the book. It's a novella. So it's shorter, but it goes fast. You're like, well, I want more. I can't put it down tonight. I just want to taste a little bit more. I don't want to sleep tonight. So also, you may have read Mike's other books, Dead Beckoning, The Devil You Knew, and its sequel, You Will Know Me by My Deeds. So Muzzle the Black Dog is fascinating. I really, really enjoy that a lot. Also, you just let things flow organically when you're writing. In terms of, you know, embracing the characters, where do you think you get this? I think it's a gift because I think a lot of people go through life just clueless, not having empathy. I call it empathy, you know, the ability to really identify with another being and just feel those feelings. So where do you think you got this gift from? Were you born this way? Have you always been fascinated?
Is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it some combination of the two? Gosh, I don't know. I will tell you that I have a hard time. I think good writers have to be very empathetic and have to always be listening to things around them. And just picking up on little things that provide insight, you know, from life around us. I don't know whether it's a gift or not. I don't know where it comes from. I've probably been an empath most of my life. But I guess it's probably some combination of nature and nurture. I don't know.
Yeah. I think you have an incredible imagination as well. In an interview, I heard you saying something about growing up with imaginary friends.
Oh, yes.
Love that.
I did. I had a few.
Yeah.
I have a couple of brothers. My middle brother, who was 7 years older than I, made fun of me sometimes for my imaginary friends, but you know. Hey, well, that's okay.
Who says they're imaginary, right? Perhaps they are real, coming through on some level.
I mean, it's like my characters are not imaginary; they're very real to me.
That's right.
Similar kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of characters fascinate you most in real life and also in your writing?
Well, that's interesting because. In the first half of The Devil You Knew, my second book, and in the latter part of You Will Know Me by My Deeds, there are two different characters who are little boys. And of all the characters, this is going to sound really strange. You know, I don't have a fetish for little boys, I promise. But okay. But
never thought that.
I have probably been most in my element and happiest when I've been focusing on those characters. On the one hand, Billy Tarwater, who's a main character in both The Devil You Knew and You Will Know Me by My Deeds. And a little boy named Brody, who plays an important role in the third book. I have loved writing about them. I have loved channeling my own experience as a little boy, that same age.
Sure.
Growing up in a, on the one hand, an idyllic time, an idyllic place for me, in a time of innocence in many respects, but also in a time where there were some very, very bad things going on that we as a society had a tendency to push to the side, under the rug, whatever, not talk about. But they still impacted me because I was still aware of them. So I love those characters.
Yes.
And I love writing about them. And they are, we will see more. Hopefully our readers, God willing, my readers will see more of them.
Oh, that's great. Of course they will.
Yeah.
You're going to channel them, so they'll come in.
Yeah, but I like writing about any characters who, I don't care whether they're good or bad characters. I mean, you know, even the bad guys, I'm not Manichaean in the sense that, you know, my books are not formulaic and that there's a good guy and a bad guy.
Right.
You know, the bad people in my books are still human beings.
Right.
With thoughts and feelings.
Yes.
And most likely a mother who loved them. And they're real, they're complex. So I love writing about characters who are complex and deep and have things to say and are trying to figure stuff out, whether they are up to no good or up to good. You know, they're still characters worth learning about and worth interrogating.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, I get that. And you sound like a psychologist now, because
we
have to come from the POV of non-judgment.
Yeah.
Complete objectivity and go back to the why and how, and perhaps there's no trauma in the backstory, or perhaps their soul is just that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever that is. You know, they came into these bodies to explore new experiences and create chaos around us all, and something like that. I don't know, but no, that's lovely. Why do you think we are so fascinated? I mean, with crime and murder and mayhem and stories, not only, I mean, we're sort of, you know, we just can't get enough in the news, but I mean, even, you know, with novels, even with stories and this short-term series we see on Netflix or on Prime, we get ourselves involved in the whodunits and the why. What's up with that? Why do we do that?
Well, I'll tell you my simple answer, and you can we can have a conversation about this from a psychology standpoint. I think it's for the same reason that people are fascinated with sex. I think we are basically voyeuristic beings.
Yes. That's really true. I agree.
You know,
and somehow it gives us insight into our own fantasies or our own fears or anything like that we're all possibly ashamed of based on what we were told or growing up with. But we can peek into that by, right?
Yeah, through the keyhole, you know?
Through the keyhole. Exactly.
Through the keyhole. And it's the same reason we love gossip.
Sure.
You know, we're voyeuristic.
Sure. Well said. No, we really are. We can learn more about ourselves that way as well.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Why does National Enquirer have such a huge circulation? At least.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love to read about those, you know, extraterrestrials. They've been, you know, I think that, you know, I think that those are fascinating newspapers, I call it that. I don't know, online sensationalist. But they say a lot of truth comes from some of those rags,
yes. Yeah.
As we say. But so for you, just to, you know, understand a little bit more about, you know, ourselves as well, what are some of your favorite films that besides, you know, of course, you know, the character of Holly Golightly and, you know, all that you talked about. But what are some of your favorite crime movies that you have really gotten into throughout the years?
Well, I mean, I mentioned one, and that I think I would put it in that category is Mulholland Drive, which
I love.
Yeah. I also love a film which you may recall as well, which is totally different but with a similar name, called Mulholland Falls. If you remember that.
I don't remember that. What?
Yeah. I will put it in the crime genre. I also like, by the way, I like Chinatown, going way back in time. I love Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And then the follow-up movie, The Two Jakes, if you remember that. Those movies,
right?
I put in that category. But I tell you, a lot of the movies that I watch are not crime movies, actually. I like movies that are from the heart. I mean, one of my favorite movies probably is a Robert Duvall movie called Tender Mercies.
I think I remember that one a lot. Why is that a favorite of yours?
Because I love, it's about redemption, and I love stories about redemption, and redemption plays a big role in my books. And the interesting thing about my books is, even though they are about crime,
yes,
I don't consider them to be formulaic crime novels. They are as much about self-discovery and redemption as they are about crime.
Right.
And so I tend to gravitate toward movies, I think, that also have that element, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
You also look at, opposites. You talk about the poem that inspired you to write this book, Muzzle of the Black Dog.
Yes.
And about the opposites of longing and isolation. I've heard you talk about close separation, inclusion and exclusion. Can you share a little bit about that poem and what drew you to that?
Yeah. So the poem, the bottom line, you know, it's about separation. It's about feeling a sense that you are present but not present. It's about being outside the window, if you will, looking in. But it's also about, out of three or four in the room, there's someone inside looking out. Who is present but not present.
Right.
Fascinating. And that really, that poem, irrespective of my fascination with Eric and Daniel Rudolph.
Yeah.
That poem, I will tell you, since I first read that poem in 1970, year that my friend was murdered, no connection, I don't believe there's a connection there, but I have remembered that poem since, for those many years.
Yes.
And it was always sort of in the back of my mind, I wanted to write something that captured the essence of that poem, that the essence of this combination of inclusion and exclusion, this sense of being present but not present.
Right.
I do include that poem in the very front of the book. Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful. And it's
paraphrase slightly, by the way. I did paraphrase the poem slightly.
Right. Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time, and I'm so sorry again for the technical difficulties we had at the beginning, but we got to jump into this. And
it happens.
It happened. There you go.
Yeah. If we have a minute, I will mention one other thing.
I'd love that, please.
So I am also, because we talked about movies a little bit, I'm working on a film adaptation of Muzzle the Black Dog, because several people encouraged me to do so.
All right.
So I am learning a little bit. I'm drinking from the fire hose, probably learning a lot,
Right.
writing a screenplay, which is so different
Oh, yes.
from
Oh,
writing a book.
absolutely.
But I'm having a blast doing it.
Oh,
So
good for you. Oh, that'll
maybe
be
one
exciting.
day, it will become real, and it'll actually be.
Oh, I'm sure it will. Good for you. These things take a long time,
Yes, they do.
as you know. But the process is fascinating. So, yes. Well, this may lead to more screenplays for you, and there you go.
Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? Thank you so much for being here with me on the couch, Mike
Thank you
Cobb.
so much, Michelle.
I love your material, your process, your writing, and sharing the organic ways in which you work. So you're a fascinating person yourself. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take good care. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening here on the couch. I appreciate it. As I always say, take care of yourselves first. That's not selfish or narcissistic. That means that if you're taking care of yourself, you'll be great for other people. You'll feel good about you, what you put out there. Thanks for joining me. Have a great one. Bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.